From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, embarrassed and humiliated New Jersey Governor Chris Christie responds to the George Washington Bridge closure scandal.
I take this action today because it's my job. I am responsible for what happened. I am sad to report to the people of New Jersey that we fell short.
Just 1 month before the international community arrives in Russia for the Winter Games, we assess just how safe the event can be, and that the UN Security Council meets to discuss the ongoing humanitarian crisis in South Sudan.
I'm now in Bentiu, which is the capital of Unity State, and I can assure you that there have been many, many tens of thousands who have been displaced here in the past 24 hours.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The Indian diplomat whose arrest last month in New York on a visa fraud charge led to protests in India has been indicted by a federal grand jury. It's understood that Devyani Kobrakati was recently granted full diplomatic immunity, which has cleared the way for her to leave the country. Kate Fisher reports from Washington.
According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, Ms. Kobrakati is accused of lying on a visa application for her former housekeeper. The indictment includes new detail about the case, including accusations that she tried to silence and intimidate the housekeeper and her family. She was recently granted full diplomatic immunity, and the U.S. State Department has requested that she leave the country. In a letter to a U.S. district judge, federal prosecutors said the charges against her will remain pending until she can be brought to court, either through a waiver of immunity or her return to the United States in a non-immune status. Kate Fisher, Washington.
The government of Afghanistan is set to release scores of prisoners because there is insufficient evidence to hold them in connection with crimes committed by the Taliban. The announcement was made in Kabul by President Hamid Karzai's office and is set to put fresh strains on the relationship between Washington and the Afghan capital. From the U.S., Simon Marks reports.
The Afghans plan to release 72 prisoners among a group of 88 formerly held by the U.S. Already furious over President Karzai's failure to sign a security agreement with the United States, the Obama administration is now urging the Afghan government not to go ahead with the releases. The White House believes there is evidence linking the detainees to the wounding or killing of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan. But the Afghans see things differently. President Karzai's spokesman saying innocent Afghans cannot be detained for extensive periods without trial.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, seen as a likely candidate for the Republican presidential nomination in 2016, has apologized for September lane closures on a major bridge connecting his state to New York City. Recently released documents suggest a top Chris Christie aide ordered the lanes closed to punish one of the governor's rivals. Quinn Bowman reports from New York.
I am embarrassed and humiliated by the conduct of some of the people on my team.
At a high-profile press conference, Christie announced that he had fired the aide, who in an email wrote that it was time for traffic problems in Fort Lee. Fort Lee's mayor did not endorse Christie in Christie's recent successful re-election bid to be New Jersey's governor. The lane closures on the George Washington Bridge caused major traffic problems there. Christie said he had no knowledge of the plot to close lanes as political payback. The governor is widely seen as a likely candidate to be the Republican Party's presidential nominee in 2016.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A rare economic criminal espionage trial is underway in San Francisco. Prosecutors accuse a U.S. businessman of conspiring to sell trade secrets from chemical giant DuPont to China. From San Francisco, Rebecca Bowering has the details.
Prosecutors allege that Walter Liu, a U.S. citizen born in Malaysia, sold secret information about titanium dioxide technology, the chemical used to make bright white pigment found in paper, paint, and plastics. The 56-year-old, who worked as an engineering consultant in California, apparently obtained DuPont's trade secrets from former employees. He's said to have sold the manufacturing formulae to four Chinese companies, making $29 million in the process. Liu is one of more than 26 individuals targeted by a government crackdown on economic espionage thought to aid China.
A French court has ordered that a banking tycoon from Kazakhstan be extradited to Russia or Ukraine to face fraud charges. The family of Mukhtar Ablyazov has argued the charges against him are politically motivated and say his life will be in danger if he's transferred to his native country. Kate Moody reports from Paris.
A one-time energy minister, 50-year-old Mukhtar Ablyazov, became an opposition leader and outspoken critic of the Kazakh government. He's accused of embezzling $6 billion from the now state-run BTA Bank, which he directed from 2005 to 2009. He received political asylum in the UK in 2011, only to flee and be arrested this July on the French Riviera. France does not have an extradition agreement with Kazakhstan, but a judge in Aix-en-Provence has approved extradition requests from both Russia and Ukraine, saying Moscow's would take precedent. Ablyazov's family says extradition to Kazakhstan would amount to a death sentence.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. He's best known as a straight-talking Republican with an eye on a 2016 presidential run. But now, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's embroiled in a scandal over a series of emails and text messages showing that his senior aides forced days of traffic jams in New Jersey as apparent punishment for a Democratic mayor who failed to endorse the governor's re-election. Today, Governor Christie told reporters he's fired the aide responsible, but meanwhile, a panel of New Jersey lawmakers voted to hold a key figure in the scandal in contempt after he refused to answer questions about it at a hearing. Lorna Shaddick has the story.
Chris Christie pulled no punches as he spoke to reporters gathered in New Jersey's state capital, Trenton, on Thursday.
I am embarrassed and humiliated by the conduct of some of the people on my team.
He was referring there to emails that were made public on Wednesday morning. They show that his deputy chief of staff, Bridget Kelly, and two other top appointees closed a pair of access lanes onto the George Washington Bridge back in September. The move caused days of gridlock and mayhem in the Fort Lee area of New Jersey. Allegedly, that was the idea, to punish the local Democratic mayor for failing to support Mr. Christie's re-election campaign. One email said, "Time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee." The reply read, "Got it." The governor previously said his office had no role in the incident. He even joked about it back in December. This is how he responded to a reporter who asked him if he had anything to do with the lane closures.
Yeah, I worked the cones, actually, Matt. Unbeknownst to everybody, I was actually the guy out there. I was in overalls and a hat, so I wasn't. But I actually was the guy working the cones out there. You really are not serious with that question.
But at this Thursday's press conference, the tone was rather more somber. Governor Christie still denied any personal involvement in the incident, but he said his deputy chief of staff had to go.
I've terminated the employment of Bridget Kelly, effective immediately. I've terminated her employment because she lied to me.
Mr. Christie went on to insist that it should be he who took the final blame.
Ultimately, I am responsible for what happens under my watch, the good and the bad. And when mistakes are made, then I have to own up to them and take the action that I believe is necessary in order to remediate them. I am sad to report to the people of New Jersey that we fell short. We fell short of the expectations that we've created over the last 4 years for the type of excellence in government that they should expect from this office.
It's this kind of behaviour, taking the blame, firing the culprits, attempting to take a decisive lead on the issue, that means many analysts believe Mr. Christie's still keeping a firm eye on the 2016 presidential race. Up until now, he's been seen as a front-runner for the Republican nomination, and Newsmax's chief political correspondent John Gizzi thinks rather than derailing Governor Christie's White House hopes, his handling of this scandal could even enhance them.
When governors take action right away, they can usually forestall a very, very bad ending and a very bad bump in their political road. Remember, this is happening 2 years before the first presidential primaries of 2016. The other thing, as I said, is the decisive action that he's taken. And one has to wonder, is this going to have shelf life? Now, anytime you fire people, and he's done this with his deputy chief of staff, as well as the political operative, he appears decisive and has the problem behind him. The young Governor Reagan in California had the misuse of his staff of a facility in Lake Tahoe, and he dealt with it in a similar way, and we know how his career went on. So I have to say about Governor Christie, when he fires people, as hard as that might be with friends of his, he at least shows he's decisive.
Nonetheless, says Mr. Gizzi, he's not out of the woods yet on this one.
He could create problems for himself. The press will continue to follow this. Right now, I'd say it slows the momentum a little bit because he does not look like the all-American governor who's just above partisan politics. That's been his stock in trade. Now he appears very partisan, but I think he's done a little bit to clean that up and put some shine on the image.
As for Mr. Christie's constituents, the jury's out on whether that shine will work or the tarnish will stick. Many New Jerseyites are still weighing up how they feel about the latest revelations.
I don't know what to think. Everything is covered up pretty much to me.
It's unconscionable that Governor Christie would allow such a thing to happen this day and age with the reputation that he has of himself of being a governor for the people.
And it's his reputation that the governor will be keeping an eye on in the next few days and weeks. Even as he was on his feet in Trenton, the U.S. Attorney's Office confirmed that it's launching an inquiry to see whether any laws were broken, placing him and some senior members of his team in potential legal jeopardy. It's the outcome of that inquiry that will finally determine whether Mr. Christie's presidential ambitions will be, for him, a bridge too far. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
This is FSN Reports.
One of the problems that we have is that those who perpetrate ethnic cleansing do not believe the international community will ever hold them accountable for their crimes against humanity. And unless we make this a real priority, unless we talk about it, we're never going to get the type of attention to accountability for those who commit crimes against humanity that we need.
Senator Ben Cardin speaking today in Washington over his concerns over how the U.S. administration will respond to reports of human rights abuses in South Sudan. The United Nations Security Council met this week to tackle the ongoing humanitarian crisis in the country. Several weeks of fighting following the failed coup attempt in the middle of December has left hundreds of thousands of people in need of help. The UN is trying to get thousands of new peacekeepers into the country, but there's a question about how many have actually arrived. Nick Harper reports from the United Nations in New York.
It was the third time in the last 2 weeks the Security Council has met to discuss the crisis in South Sudan. The last two were emergency crisis sessions, where the Council approved sending 5,500 peacekeepers and more than 400 UN police to help the hundreds of thousands of civilians who've been caught up in the fighting. Originally, the head of UN peacekeeping said he hoped to have them all on the ground by the end of next week. On Thursday, the UN spokesperson Farhan Haq refused to give an overall assessment of how many had actually arrived.
We're still in the process of trying to get those additional troops to come in. Nepal will make up one of the battalions to reinforce the UN mission in South Sudan, which will include 350 troops redeploying from the UN mission in Haiti, with approximately further 500 troops deploying from Nepal.
To get them there quicker, many are coming from other UN missions around Africa, including those in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Darfur, and Liberia. Those that have arrived have been sent as reinforcements to some of the most volatile areas, including Bor, Bentiu, and the capital, Juba. But the humanitarian crisis is getting worse. 231,000 are being helped in camps around the country. They fled their homes to escape the fighting. And UN humanitarian coordinator Toby Lanza believes that figure is increasing by the hour.
Yesterday we were talking about 200,000 people who had been displaced in South Sudan, but I'm now in Bentiu, which is the capital of Unity State, and I can assure you that there have been many, many tens of thousands who have been displaced here in the past 24 hours.
Flights are landing almost daily, bringing essential relief supplies for those in the camps. Things like blankets, cooking supplies, and plastic sheeting to make temporary shelters. Joseph Contreras, a spokesperson for the South Sudan mission, has been at the airport in Juba to receive the aid.
This is the second of a planned 8 supply flights using this Royal Australian Air Force transport plane. They are operating out of the global support base of the United Nations in Brindisi, Italy. And this is a tremendous assistance and support for an already overstretched peacekeeping mission.
But many South Sudanese are also crossing borders to get away from the violence. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says the number of refugees in neighbouring countries is rising rapidly, now totaling an estimated 43,000. 2,500 South Sudanese are crossing the border into Uganda every day. Ethiopia and Kenya are also taking people in, something that Melissa Fleming from the UNHCR says is severely stretching those countries' resources.
We're noticing that as the fighting continues, the fear continues, people are opting to leave in other directions. 5,000 at least registered now in Ethiopia. 300 South Sudanese are arriving every single day in the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya.
With more people seeking help by the day, and the UN mission in South Sudan not yet up to full strength, the race is on to get more peacekeepers there as soon as possible. Nick Harper, New York.
5 people were found shot dead in cars in the southern Russian region of Stavropol just a few weeks before the Sochi Olympics. The victims, who include taxi drivers, were left inside 4 vehicles, 2 of which were booby-trapped. Russian police are hunting suspected Islamist militants in connection with the case. Earlier, I spoke to our Moscow correspondent, Anya Ardayeva, about security leading up to the international event.
This is a very strange shooting attack. Indeed, just a month before Winter Olympic Games in Sochi are set to begin, 6 people were found dead in 4 cars in the area of Pyatigorsk late on Wednesday. That area of Pyatigorsk is only 200 miles to the west from Sochi. Now, 3 men whose bodies were found in those cars have been identified, and none of them have anything to do with terrorism or army or anything like that. 2 men were taxi drivers, and the third was assembling furniture for a private businessman. That's according to the Russian media. Their names have not been released, and the men are said to be local residents, and they drove an expensive Russian cars. It's not clear what was the motive behind that crime. Explosives were found in most of the cars, either outside or inside the cars, including booby traps. Some observers here suggested that this may be an effort to sort of destabilize the situation in the area prior to the games, an effort either by the organized crime or by Islamic militants who are operating in nearby Caucasus.
And if we add this latest incident to what occurred in Volgograd, when some 34 people were killed in 2 separate terrorist attacks, it makes for uneasy reading for those athletes and spectators who are going to descend upon Sochi from around the world. What are the Russian authorities doing to allay any concerns over security and a potential terrorist threat?
Heightened security measures came into force in Sochi on January 7th, just 1 month before the Olympic Games. And this means that all security personnel there is now on combat alert. And now these measures, which are to be in place until March 21st, also include a ban on all non-local cars entering the city without a special Olympic pass. And that certainly created some tension among the local residents who did not obtain that pass and who will not be able to drive their cars. The Russian Emergencies Ministry said it is planning to use space monitoring capabilities to forecast possible emergencies. A spokesman for that ministry said that a special system of monitoring and emergencies forecasting has been already put in place, and that comes in addition to a surveillance system that will include drones, reconnaissance robots, and high-speed patrol boats. Now, all internet and other communication traffic will be monitored throughout the games. In addition, Russian media also reported that over 400 Cossacks already arrived in Sochi on Thursday to help local police. Now, those Cossacks will accompany police patrols, and they will wear their full uniform, which includes tunics, fur hats, and even swords. So that will be quite a colorful scene. Now, 37,000 police and interior ministry troops are expected to be on duty during the games, and that's nearly double of the entire security personnel of the Olympic Games in London 2 years ago. Police officers were reportedly trained to communicate with the guests at the games in three languages, in addition to Russian. That would be English, French, and German. And a special hotline has been established, 24-hour hotline, where people can call in case of an emergency.
And finally, do you think there's any conversation being had about whether or not this unparalleled security project that's going to be cast over the entire Sochi Games is actually going to do anything detrimental to the spirit of the Olympic event?
Because the measures are indeed unprecedented, and terrorist attacks on the eve of the Games certainly add to the tension that is likely to be felt by the guests and the participants during the Games. And of course, that tension is likely to grow as more guests arrive and as athletes arrive and face a very tough and very serious security measures that are to be implemented in Sochi.
Our Moscow correspondent, Anya Ardaeva. Luxury car maker Rolls-Royce has reported its fourth year in a row of record sales, delivering over 3,600 cars to customers worldwide in 2013. All of this despite tough economic conditions in many parts of the world. Sales jumped in China and the Middle East for the automaker, whose top-of-the-range Phantom model retails starting at over $400,000. British-based Rolls-Royce has told FSN reports it's bullish about the African market and keen to explore Myanmar as a possibility in Asia too. But the US remains crucial, as Chief Executive Officer Torsten Müller-Oidfoss told FSN's Ollie Barrett in the back of a Phantom cruising around London's Mayfair.
The United States and China are our main pillars of business, always have been over the last years. And it was again a head-to-head race, particularly at the end of the year. So for that reason, China, yes, overtook United States, but by very, very small numbers. So you could even say it was a coincidence or whatsoever. More important for me is that we are globally and nicely balanced in all kind of different markets, including the Middle East, Europe, Asia, China, United States. And we aren't putting our eggs in one basket, which is important, I think. And for that reason, I'm satisfied with the outcome at the end.
That was my next question. With China so important and some people worried about a slowdown in China, is that a problem for Rolls-Royce?
I mean, we are now probably close to 28% of the total volume comes out of the Chinese market, which is, yes, it is a big part, but as there are also other countries around in the world. And for that reason, I don't see the Chinese market falling apart or whatsoever. I would even say that the market is on a very good path currently with economic developments. Yes, they have seen some slowdowns over the last 1 and 2 years, but that is also very much due to the fact that the car market in general in China matures more and more and more, which is logic.
Where else is exciting you in Asia? Hanoi, Manila? What is exciting Rolls-Royce elsewhere on the continent?
I mean, we had an excellent year in Japan, thanks to Ebonomics, and that was really outstanding last year. We are constantly enlarging our footprint in the Asian markets. We have invested into Vietnam last year, also into Thailand, and for that reason we are expanding our footprint in a way, because there is still more potential in Asian markets in particular, maybe this year also in Myanmar and other locations. Yeah.
Myanmar is interesting. Are you advanced in trying to get into that country?
I mean, for us it is the question, is a market sustainable for some time? For instance, we also entered last year into the Philippines. Yeah? And it's very important for us to understand how is the structure of population. Do we see our customer group growing over the years to come? And that happens particularly in Philippines, will also, I think, happen in Myanmar. And when we see the potential, which is not harvesting low-hanging fruits just by 1 year, but really sustainable business over the years to come, then we are prepared to invest.
This is FSN Reports.
Ah bah c'est toujours identitaire, hein. Voilà, t'es chinois, voilà, on se fout sur la gueule et puis c'est tout. Et voilà, même lui il le sait, oui, il le sait que ça se passe.
The voice of controversial French stand-up comic Dieudonné. Just before the comic was due to appear on stage in the city of Nantes, the High Court in France upheld a ban on a show by Dieudonné just hours before he was due on. His shows have been criticised as anti-Semitic and his new performance is thought to contain derogatory material targeting Jews. The comic's lawyer argued Dieudonné's right to free speech was being breached. He is still scheduled to perform at a number of French venues as part of his nationwide tour. And Dominique Moissy, senior advisor for the French Institute of International Relations in Paris, explained to me why the comic has attracted so much attention.
A comic is deliberately using anti-Semitic and racist argument in his show. And the public comes, some of them precisely because they want to hear anti-Semitic comments, others because they find him funny or they find him anti-system. And this has been going on for years. And the level of provocation reached by this humorist has become so unacceptable to a majority of the political class that they have decided to, in fact, attack him and now to forbid his show to go on.
So Dieudonné's lawyer, the French comics lawyer, suggested that banning the show, or argued that banning the show would be a clear breach of principle of free expression. Has there been any support for that point of view in France?
Yes. Clearly, the debate is as such. For on the one hand, people are saying, we don't like Dieudonné, he is disgusting, but we must support the freedom of expression. Because if we start by banning what he says, we are endangering democracy and the process of the state of law. The rule of law. Others would say you cannot allow the possibility to insult the dignity of others, to hurt them deliberately by making fun, in that particular case, of the Shoah, of the Holocaust. And in fact, it sees a debate that reminds me very much of the debate that took place at the time of the cartoon against Islam in 2005 in Denmark. Do you have the right, when you speak of freedom of expression, to insult what is the most sanctified in the others? The Prophet Muhammad, in the case of Muslims, and the Shoah, in the case of Jews.
Maybe it's not a case of the show must go on, but a case of the show perhaps will go on, because Dieudonné, he is booked to play a series of other French venues up until the summer of this year, so perhaps we haven't heard the last of this controversy.
Absolutely. This is an ongoing battle. The show will not go on in Nantes tonight, but clearly there might be riots, clashes between police and people who cannot see the show, or the show. Dieudonné will try to give the show in the parking space. We don't know. But it's the beginning of a rather messy and confused story.
Dominique Moissy in Paris. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of our programme by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there, @FeatureStory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.